This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on December 6th, 2012. Should have questions if they're listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-37, Yamaha Motor Corporation. We have with us on the phone this morning Lisa McManus and Brian Tyson, both representing the requester. Are you on the phone? Mr. Tyson? Mr. Tyson?
Good morning.
Good morning. I will turn you over to Chair Hunter.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. McManus. Are you on as well?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. We'll start off with a presentation from the Office of General Counsel, Mr. Buckley.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda Document 12-84 contains draft advisory opinions that respond to a request submitted on behalf of Yamaha Motor Corporation USA. Yamaha is a California corporation that is a wholly owned subsidiary of a foreign corporation. Yamaha asks whether it may establish a separate segregated fund and solicit contributions to that SSF from the executive and administrative personnel of a Yamaha division's dealers and service centers, as well as from the dealers and service centers that are individuals or partnerships. Both drafts conclude that Yamaha may create an SSF. The drafts differ, however, on whether the SSF may solicit Yamaha's dealers and service centers. Draft A concludes that Yamaha's SSF may not solicit contributions from the dealers and service centers because Yamaha does not maintain sufficient control over the business policies, practices, and procedures of its dealer service centers to conclude that Yamaha is affiliated with them. Draft B concludes that Yamaha's SSF may solicit contributions from the dealers and service centers because Yamaha does maintain sufficient control over the business policies, practices, and procedures of its dealers and service centers to conclude that Yamaha is affiliated with them. The Commission received no comments on the request and one comment on the drafts. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley. And I'd also like to note that the deadline for this advisory opinion is January 4th, so we do have another open meeting between now and the deadline to consider it if we're not able to vote on this draft today. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Tyson or Ms. McManus? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to ask, I'll address it to both you, Mr. Tyson and Ms. McManus, just to get a little bit more clarification on the extent of the control that Yamaha has over its dealerships and service centers. You mentioned that advance approval is required of Yamaha before there can be any change in ownership or management of a dealer or service center. And does that, in effect, give Yamaha a veto in the sense that if they were to change ownership or management without Yamaha's approval, that could lead to, I guess, maybe perhaps termination under the terms of the agreement? If you could provide a little bit more clarity and flesh that out a little bit more, that would be helpful.
And Commissioner, this is Brian Tyson. I think that authority definitely exists for Yamaha under the agreement, under the language. That Yamaha would definitely have the ability to terminate the agreement if change in management or control took place that they did not approve. Maybe Ms. McManus can offer a little more specifics on how it operates within Yamaha.
Yes, hi, this is Lisa McManus. The dealer agreement does provide that the dealer must provide us notice of any change in ownership or management, and we have to approve of any change of ownership or management. If we don't approve or if the dealer fails to provide us any notice, then Yamaha has the option of terminating the dealer agreement. There is a provision in 7.1, the last sentence, which says any transfer which is not made in accordance with this section is void. There's also Section 7.2, which discusses our rights to terminate as well.
Okay. And is it also the case in both your request and also in the comments after the drafts came out, you list all the different areas in which you have control over your dealership, over the dealers and service centers, including, you know, training of personnel, display of products, inventory, ensuring that, requiring that they service anybody who has bought a Yamaha product, and so on and so forth. And failure to comply with any of those could also result in termination?
That is correct.
Okay. One further question I have is on exclusivity. In 1.4 of the agreement, it has a non-exclusive provision talking about the rights granted herein are non-exclusive. Is this sort of a non-exclusivity provision fairly common in this sort of an agreement between either a franchisor or franchisees, distributors, dealerships, and so on?
Brian, I'll just make sure I understand. Do you mean in an industry as a whole or within Yamaha?
Just to the extent you can comment on the larger industry.
And Commissioner, related to the non-exclusivity, related to the rights granted in the dealer agreement. So, as far as just to make sure I understand, the reservation of rights that Yamaha has is to pursue additional rights available to it. Mr. McManus, can you speak to that anymore?
Okay. Yeah, that's because when I was looking at this, and I also was looking back at some of the other AOs we've had, for example, Dunkin' Donuts, they had a provision that was very similar to this in their in the agreement that they had with their franchisees as well. So I took it from that this sort of a provision in these agreements seems to be fairly commonplace.
Yeah, it gives us the right to find additional dealers and not have exclusivity to one dealer.
And finally, just wanted to have you kind of flesh out your comments. You expressed concern about the focus in Draft A over exclusivity, and almost that becomes the dispositive factor, even though it's not listed as a factor in the affiliation provision in 100.5 of our regulations. When looking at, even though it's a non-exclusive list, it's a demonstrative list, yet exclusivity is not included there, but you expressed concerns that seems to be the primary focus in Draft A, and I just wanted to get your further thoughts on that.
Yes, Commissioner, and the concern there is that if exclusivity is going to become the rule, then it, in a sense, it'll be much easier to determine affiliation going forward. And if the rule is going to be exclusivity governs the issue, then it seems to be superfluous to have all the additional reviews of governance if the key question is the exclusive nature of the relationship.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. Just following up on Commissioner Peterson's point on asking about exclusivity. My understanding of the outboard motor world is you may have Joe's outboard motor and you walk in and they have the Yamaha section, they might have the Evinrude section, they have but that's just the way outboard motors have always been sold. And I guess it's not exclusive because they sell competing engines, but that to me is not fatal. But I'm also concerned, I agree with the comments, Draft A does really focus a lot on the exclusivity, but could you maybe help us factually, if my point makes any sense to you, about how outboards are actually sold? Because I think there's always a concern when you do an AO that you worry about what it means for the next guy and how this affects what's happening. And to me, the way outboards are sold is a little bit unique. It's kind of weird. There's no such thing as a little bit unique, but unique compared to right. other products. I don't think you have stores that are exclusive Yamaha outboard motors or exclusive Evinrude or exclusive Johnson or whoever else is out there. I think you always have sort of the marine products or maybe the outboard motor store that sells multiple brands, but yet still has a lot of control over how their particular product is sold. You get just going through the facts that I know. You have the district marketing manager who visits no less than quarterly. They can't use Yamaha as part of their corporate name, but they can use it in advertising so long as it complies with the manual that you give them. It seems to me you're exercising a lot of control over someone who's not exclusive. And I guess the question is this something that's just inherent in how you sell outboard motors? I mean, is it really realistic to actually say you could have an exclusive outboard motor dealership and you would still sell enough outboard motors to make it worth selling outboard motors? Or do you really need to do it the way you've been doing it, what I think has been for years and years and years and years?
Brian, I'll take a shot at this. I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. The marine industry is unique in that we do have a few exclusive dealers, but compared to the total number of dealers we have, that number is very small. And the reason being is that generally, unless you're in a certain area or market, a marine dealer needs to carry competitive lines in order to stay in business. And so you're right, the marine industry is unique in that situation where that is the norm, where exclusivity is not the norm. And
could I ask where the exclusive ones are?
A lot of them in Florida.
Because you can sell enough outboards to make a go of it being exclusive.
Right.
Okay.
Yep, a lot of them in the southeast and in Florida.
Okay.
The other question that you raised, or the other comment that you raised, was correct in that Yamaha still does retain a significant amount of control over the dealers, regardless of exclusivity, in addition to controlling the trademarks and the district marketing managers who are in there all the time and reviewing things and on our dealer agreements. Brian, did you want to comment further?
I think that's exactly what I was going to say. So perfect.
One final question factually. The application process that a dealer has to go through to become a Yamaha dealer, could you elaborate on that a little bit? It seems rather extensive. This is not a question where somebody can just declare themselves a Yamaha dealer and start selling engines, and then you're going to think you can solicit them for your pack. There's quite a bit of paperwork and quality control that goes into the process. Am I right on that?
Yes, you are correct. There is a new dealer packet, and the packet is quite extensive. It goes through an array of financial questions and business policy questions, and it also includes a review by the credit department, the finance department, the district marketing manager, the regional manager, and then the president of the marine group as well, to all approve the setup of a new dealer. It is a process.
Mr. Herman? Mr. Herman is our general counsel.
Good morning. I take it the operative provision that we're talking about in terms of exclusivity is 2.3. Am I right?
Yes.
Yes, that's correct.
And am I right that there's nothing in this agreement that precludes a dealer from having franchise relationships with other manufacturers in addition to Yamaha? So, for example, to use Commissioner McGann's example, a dealer could have a franchise relationship, at least under this agreement, with both Yamaha and Evinrude.
Correct.
Thank you.
And one additional point I'll raise, Mr. Herman, is that I think that since this is a licensee-type relationship as opposed to a franchise relationship, Mr. McManus can probably speak to whether that's standard in the industry or not, but I'm not sure that it would necessarily be a franchise relationship as opposed to they could have other licensing agreements with other manufacturers.
Commissioner McGann has a follow-up to that. That's okay. Commissioner McGann.
Let's assume we say yes, Yamaha can have a pack, and yes, you can solicit these folks. What if Evinrude has the same exact system and also wants to solicit these folks? How do you have any thoughts on how we deal with that? Because you're going to have Joe's Outboard potentially being within the restricted class of multiple packs, which maybe that isn't fatal. I don't know. But it seems to me that you could have the same guy as in a bunch of different pack worlds.
Commissioner, I guess that's a possibility. I think the question will be, though, is the relationship that the dealer has with Evinrude as intrusive as the relationship with Yamaha? And sitting here today, I don't know the answer to that question, but it would appear that if a dealer is willing to surrender a significant amount of governance control, that they at least should be affiliated with the one that has the most surrender.
Commissioner Bowerly.
So would that mean if Evinrude came in and said, we require more specificity with respect to where you place our motors compared to the other motors, and that they could we find that there's an affiliation here, and then that could be trumped by a later request for affiliation from another entity by proving that they have more control than Yamaha does? I mean, would this become some... I think your suggestion is that you have a lot, and so you should have affiliation. But what if someone came in, Evinrude came in and exercised even more control? They wanted to control the color of the floor so that their motors stood out on the floor, and other details that are more akin to some of the things like the fairly rigid approach that Duncan takes to its franchisees. Would you suggest that we could revisit this question at that point in time?
Oh, no, Commissioner, I didn't mean to suggest that. What I meant to suggest was that if Evinrude exercises a similar level of control over a dealer that Yamaha does, then the way I would see it is they would have to be affiliated with both organizations. If the question truly is a governance question, and then from a practical perspective, I'm not sure a dealer would be able to surrender that much control to everyone if they're having to give financial reports to Yamaha and Evinrude and having to meet the requirements of Yamaha and Evinrude and everyone else. That's a significant intrusion on the day-to-day management. So from a practical perspective, I'm not certain if someone's willing to do that or if that's a practice in the industry.
And I was just throwing out Evinrude as an example. My family's always been Johnson Motors, so no offense to Yamaha, but that's just where we are. I wanted to a comment, because I want to make sure that you're not left with a misimpression of Draft A, although Draft A very clearly says significantly the exclusivity is absent. I think from my perspective in doing this analysis, exclusivity gives us sort of a shortcut to some of the issues at hand, including how much control of the day-to-day operations, how much control of the governance. Absent that, we just have to look deeper into the facts. And here, as I read your agreements, while it does have some requirements, and again, at least as much prominence of your products versus any other that might be sold, obviously you retain use of your marks, which is pretty common in any, frankly, contractual relationship. It just seems to me that comes down to a factual question of how much, as you, I think the word you put, intrusion, and this is, these are each affiliation question is very fact-based. So, and it's a little bit of a spectrum where you fall on the spectrum of how much control and versus how free a business owner is to operate their business in a day-to-day manner. I do have a question about management. When you say management and ownership, is there a level of ownership with each particular dealer that you look at? Is it the manager of the entire operation? Do you have any control over other employees in the operation?
The control generally, from a practical matter, is with the owners and the key personnel. And generally the key personnel is the general manager and the managers of if there's, it depends on how the corporation is set up, but it's the owners, the general managers, and then the key managers, which would be generally service and sales.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the question that Commissioner McGann raised about the, you know, what if Evinrude wants to do it too, is a question that I also had been, it's an important question. It's one that I had been thinking about also. I mean, ultimately, what we're grappling with here is how much control is enough control to pass the test under our regulations. And I think that's a question that different commissioners could come to different conclusions on. I think this may be a case of first impression. I can't recall another request like this where there wasn't an exclusive relationship. I mean, you know, Dunkin' Donuts only sells Dunkin' Donuts. They don't sell other people's. They don't sell Krispy Kremes at a Dunkin' Donuts franchise. Does council?
Anheuser-Busch was a beer distributor that also distributed other brands. And that's the closest analogy to this, but it's not directly.
Anheuser-Busch itself distributed.
Okay. No, they were seeking to make their wholesalers within their restricted class, and their wholesalers sold other brands besides Anheuser-Busch brands.
I have to admit that the thing that I most recall about that was that they wanted to give out beer they wanted to give out six packs as an incentive.
to the commission?
Not to the commission. To I guess big pack participants.
And we said yes.
We did. We said yes. You know, I think that exclusivity has to come into play at some point. And I don't know that this is actually a unique sales arrangement. I mean, there are a lot of companies that market their products in different ways. You know, there are some that will market exclusively through their own dealerships, and then there are others that will market both through their own dealerships and through other arrangements. I mean, I think about, for example, in the clothing industry, you can go to a Tommy Hilfiger store and buy only Tommy Hilfiger products, or you can go to Macy's or Nordstrom's and buy Tommy Hilfiger products there. I don't know that if Tommy Hilfiger wanted to come in and claim that the managers at Macy's or Nordstrom's were part of their restricted class, that we would find that particularly compelling argument. I don't think I would. I mean, you could take it to a silly extent, I suppose. I think I come up with these ideas in my head, and I think, well, that's a silly one. But then I'm reluctant to say, because maybe somebody wouldn't think it was silly. But what I think would be a silly example would be if the Slim Jim company wanted to say that every 7-Eleven manager was a member of their restricted class because they sell Slim Jims there, when obviously they sell all sorts of other things there, and there's no exclusivity there. So I think that would be a silly example. But my point being that it may not be the be-all and the end-all, but it's part of it's implicitly part of the analysis, and goes to the level of and is related to the level of control that is exercised. I'm not sure that we've ever been asked whether somebody could be, you know, whether a dealer like this could be part of two restricted classes for two entirely different companies. I don't think so. No, okay, counsel's confirming on that, and I don't know that I would feel comfortable with that. I suppose the analogy would be more like in the trade association PAC world, where you know, it's not exactly the same, but, you know, somewhat analogous, where we say, you know, yes, you may be part of several trade associations, but you can only be part of the solicitable class for one of them. Do you have a comment on that, Commissioner?
I think the better analogy is members of corporate boards. You can be a board member of many corporations, and you're still within the restricted class of each corporation. Trade association rules are a little bit different. They're their own creature. So the idea of you're going to hit up the same person more than once is not foreign to campaign finance law.
I guess it just whether you think the trade associations are more comparable to this than the corporate boards. I ask my colleagues how they. This is really not a question for the requester, but suppose Evan Rood did come in and say, "Well, we also exercise a certain degree of control." Would do you think that the same dealership could be part of the same of the restricted class for two separate manufacturers?
By analogy to the, you can have more than one person, you can have the same person on multiple corporate boards and therefore more than be a member of more than one restricted class, I think you could be. I mean, to get it even trickier, what if Joe's outboard decided to have their own pack? Right? And then could they do, well, they could, I guess, but yeah. I mean, how many Joe's outboards are really going to have packs? You know, I mean, Tommy Hilfiger is not selling marine engines that, you know, require maintenance and it's a different kind of. I think the marine industry, and that's why I was going with my questions. I think this is different. It's different than alcohol. Alcohol is, you know, a long history in this company, country of how it's sold, and sometimes for certain periods of time not sold, and then sold again. Wholesalers and distributors, and there's, you know, state taxes, and Virginia has an ABC board and all that stuff. So this really is. I think you're right. First time, this is case of first impression, and I think the way outboard motors are sold is different than how clothing sold and alcohol is sold. But yet, I mean, my guess is if Yamaha...
Slim Jims.
What's that?
Or Slim Jims.
Slim Jims, right. Yeah, that was a good one. I think we have consensus on Slim Jim would not make every 7-Eleven part of the restricted class. We take agreement where we can find it here.
That's for sure.
Yeah, you know, part of this comes from me just because you know, I'm a creature of the East Coast and growing up near the water, and we're not a court. We're not limited to record evidence, and, you know, you don't think you put on an FEC commissioner because he knows something about outboard motors. I actually am a sailboat guy, not a motorboat guy, but and in that world, there's a big difference, a deeper divide than sometimes we have here at the commission. And that's why I was trying to get the requester to flesh out a little bit more factually why this is not – I don't see this as something that goes beyond the world of marine motorboat engines just because of the way they sell it. Now, maybe there is an analogous industry, but I can't think of one off the top of my head. And, again, I bring to the table just walking to Joe's outboard and seeing the very prominent Yamaha display and all that, you know, the way they do advertising, and it all rings true to me, what the requester's saying, which is why the exclusivity thing doesn't scare me. Multiple restricted classes, that doesn't, unless someone has a reason, a precedent says you can't be in more than one restricted class, that's not a concern of mine on these facts. And I don't eat Slim Jim, so I really can't get into it too much. But some people think they're delicious.
Any other comments or questions for the requester? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tyson and Ms. McManus. That was a very helpful conversation. We will not vote on this today, but intend to do so at the next public meeting, which is December 20th. And if it's okay with everybody, I'd like to note on our website, if possible, that we discussed it at this meeting and that we're accepting public comments until December 19th at noon. I think sometimes when we talk about something in an open meeting and then talk about it again, we need to make it a little bit more clear that we're willing to take comments from anybody, obviously the requester, but anybody else, and maybe note that on the website. Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next